And people in the courtroom and the bench, that this is September 11th, an anniversary of an unfortunate event in the history of the United States, in which many of our people lost their lives or were injured and are still suffering from the variety of injuries. And as we argue important cases in the lives of the litigants and in the law of this state, in New York City and elsewhere, the names of the victims are being recited. And I would say, as I have said in past years on September 11th, that we take a moment of recognizing and grieving for those who were injured or killed and their families who and friends who still remember them. I will now call 2005 AP 1677 Ralph Schmidt versus Northern States Power Company. Representing Northern State Power Company is Jordan. Is it Hamaden?
Hamaden, Your Honor.
Hamaden. You will have 25 minutes to argue. Then we're going to have 20 minutes of argument by Andrea. Is it Neeson or Nice Neeson? Who will represent the Schmidts. We will have 10 minutes argument by Charles Bird, who also represents the Schmidt. You're dividing your time. And then, counsel, you will have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Is that the agreement? Okay. Counsel, you may proceed. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, I am Jordan Hamaden, attorney for Northern States Power, to whom I'll refer as NSP in this argument. Assisting me today is one of my partners at Michael Best, John Wilson. There are two fundamental aspects of Wisconsin law at stake in this appeal. First, whether Wisconsin is going to enforce the terms and conditions of contracts in the utility context known as tariffs between their utilities and their customers. The second question is whether there really is any statute of limitations in Wisconsin for stray voltage claims, because if there isn't one in this case, I would contend there probably isn't in any.
You were present for the prior argument on statute of limitations. Okay, thank you.
In this case, the Court of Appeals effectively answered no to both of these questions, and NSP requests that this Court reverse the Court of Appeals, first to reaffirm the principles and importance of the filed tariff doctrine in this state, and second, to reaffirm a defendant's right, including in stray voltage cases, to a statute of limitations defense. I would like to begin by following up a little bit on the discourse between counsel in the last case and Justice Prosser on some very fundamental realities about stray voltage. First, an inescapable feature of the multi-grounded distribution system used throughout this country is that there will always be some level of neutral to ground voltage. The Public Service Commission and even the appellate courts of this state and experts on the summary judgment record, who were uncontroverted in this case, have acknowledged that this voltage is a natural byproduct of any grounded electrical system. Now, when this neutral to ground voltage, again, always present to some extent, is transmitted through a cow from contact points on the property, it is known in the vernacular as stray voltage. It is also generally understood that stray voltage has two sources, either wiring on the farm or the utility's distribution system. Since neutral to ground voltage is always present to some extent, and therefore always some chance that it could manifest itself as stray voltage, it is recognized that it is not practically possible to eliminate stray voltage entirely. Rather, the question is a matter of controlling stray voltage. This case, more than anything else, is about the extent of NSP's or any other utility's duty to control it. The PSC has extensively, and from a governmental standpoint exclusively, studied stray voltage in the direction of the legislature in Wisconsin. and has done so for more than 20 years. Based on these extensive investigations, which were open to all stakeholders throughout the state for input, the PSC set a very conservative threshold called the level of concern of utility-induced stray voltage, and that level is 0.5 volts. Now, the Commission observed, based on the best science available in its orders on stray voltage, that at this level of concern, only the most sensitive cows could even perceive the presence of electricity. In addition, the PSC noted that voltage levels 4 times this level of concern do not compromise milk production or introduce disease. The summary judgment record in this case is clear that NSP never detected more than the level of concern of stray voltage at the Schmitz farm, except when testing in hypothetical conditions. That brings me to the filed tariff doctrine argument.
So it brings you to the filed tariff doctrine argument if we assume that your testing was properly done, correct? If we would conclude there was evidence in the record that somebody else tested and got higher records, then you don't get to the filed rate doctrine, do you?
I think you do.
Okay, you explain how.
And the reason you do is because NSP's tariff, the stray voltage section of its tariff, specifies, based on the Commission's expertise, what kinds of tests have to be done and when. The contention is that if NSP conducts the tests the way it's supposed to, using the methodologies it is supposed to, and then proceeds according to those test results, it has complied with its tariff, and its obligations cannot be enlarged or varied by tort or any other claims.
Now, I'm sorry, I probably didn't state my concern correctly or clearly. If another person tests for stray voltage and that person is an expert in stray voltage and finds that there is stray voltage at 0.5 volts, if Northern States Power had only found it as a lesser level, isn't there then a question about whether Northern States Power's tests were properly performed?
I think that there could be a contention in a stray voltage case, Your Honor, that Northern States Power did not conduct its tests in accordance with the tariff procedures. And if it had not, and if it did not proceed the way it was supposed to based on the test results it should have derived using proper methods, then I would say there could be some liability.
Okay.
The question here more narrowly is, if a utility complies with the terms and conditions set forth in its tariff, and here we have detailed terms and conditions with respect to stray voltage, should it be open to any liability? Under the
Can we determine that on summary judgment? Because that's how we're here. There was never a trial, so there wasn't evidence, as I understand it. Can you just determine that on summary judgment?
Well, in this case, Your Honor, Judge Counsel did determine on summary judgment that there was no evidence that NSP had not complied with the obligations it has under its tariff. And on that basis, the judge concluded that the filed tariff doctrine precludes the common law claims in this case.
But if someone – well, never mind. I'm belaboring the point. I understand your position. Thank you.
Let me just pick that up. In the last case, and you were here in her, I recall that NSP, at least according to some suggested facts, did a testing in May of 1996 and found the level well below that determined by the PSC. And yet later that same month, they used certain kind of equipment, like a slow metroscope or metro something. And then, later that same month, the master electrician hired by the plaintiffs in that case did testing which showed the measurement way far in excess. So it seems to me, using different equipment, like one, it was a fast, it was something fast, a fast recording oscilloscope.
Your Honor, I'm unfortunately not familiar enough with the measurements taken in the Gumbs case to speak with some authority to how that would relate to this case. But what I would respond with is that there are probably, for 1,000 different experts, 1,000 different methods of taking such tests. And I think that what we have to remember is that the Public Service Commission, over 20 years and a pile of paper this high, determined what the tests had to be and how they were to be conducted. And NSP, there's no evidence in this case that NSP tested in any manner inconsistent with the requirements of that tariff. And we have to rely on the agency findings and the wisdom of the agency that's been charged by the legislature to figure out what the right way is to go about this. And once...
Counsel, how do you get around the Hoffman case? Doesn't the Hoffman case resolve this issue?
No, Your Honor, the Hoffman case does not resolve it. And the primary reason is that in Hoffman, the issue of whether the filed tariff doctrine applies was never raised. The issue in Hoffman was whether the methods and procedures set forth by a commission in an order did anything to limit the rights and obligations of the parties with respect to stray voltage. Here what we are contending is that once NSP, at the order of the commission, incorporated those methods, procedures, and mitigation measures into its tariff, that became law. And under the filed tariff doctrine, there's no exception which we could carve out in this case, which would preserve the filed tariff doctrine as we know it in Wisconsin. A few things about NSP's tariff I think are very important to remember. Section 8 puts all of NSP's customers on notice that there might be stray voltage present on their property and describes what NSP must do if a stray voltage problem is suspected and confirmed. The summary judgment record is clear that NSP did what Section 8 required it to do. Now, the filed tariff doctrine was adopted by this court in the early part of last century based on U.S. Supreme Court precedent, and it has several components which together define the legal relationship between a utility and its customers. First, customers accept service from their utility provider under the terms and conditions set forth in the tariff, regardless of whether they agree to those terms and conditions. Second, as the Court of Appeals in this state has observed, the filed tariff then governs the conduct of the utility and its customers. As the U.S. Supreme Court similarly noted, 10 years ago in AT&T versus Central Office Telephone, the filed and approved tariff, NSP's tariff in this case, is the exclusive source of the terms and conditions by which the common carrier provides service to its customers.
Does that case bind this court, or can the court say something different?
Your Honor, I would not say that the AT&T case is mandatory precedent, but I would say that it is highly instructive. And it's highly instructive because the same antecedents that the court relied on in AT&T versus Central Office Telephone are the same cases which this course has based its jurisprudence on, including
Keogh.
Well,
it's your position that tariff setting this stray voltage number is exclusive.
Yes, Your Honor.
It wipes out the common law doctrine of negligence or nuisance. I mean, is that your position?
Your Honor, I wouldn't say it wipes it out. What I would
say, for purposes of this case?
For purposes of this case, it does, and given the summary judgment record.
Oh, now that's different. Forget summary judgment record in this case. Just as a principle of law, does the tariff, file tariff, is that exclusive and means that there is no cause of action for negligence or nuisance?
So long as the utility complied with the terms of the tariff, yes.
Okay. And could that test be different at different hours of the day or night?
Which test, Your Honor?
Stray voltage. Can you have a different reading at 9 in the morning and 5 p.m.?
I would suspect that it's possible to have different readings at different times of day.
But it's exclusive. The tariff is exclusive.
Yes, Your Honor. Okay. Now, the longstanding corollary of the principles
If I can follow up the Chief's question, has this court or has the Court of Appeals ever adopted the position you just advanced?
Your Honor, I don't think this Court has had the occasion to address whether the terms and conditions in a tariff versus the rates are the subject of the filed rate doctrine. But all of the cases that this Court has referred to in the development of the filed rate doctrine in Wisconsin are the very cases that the AT&T Court relied on. And the reason that it makes sense to interpret the cases this way is because you cannot separate rates from terms and conditions, not in a commercial contract, not in a tariff. The rates at which a service is provided is necessarily connected to the level of service that's being provided. What we have to remember here is that we are trying to strike a balance in this tariff and what the Public Service Commission has done with its rules.
Counsel, I understand your answer is that this Court has not done so, but I also asked about the Court of Appeals. Has the Court of Appeals ever adopted the position that you've just advanced here today with respect to the tariffs and how it relates to issues of liability as long as the utility follows all the terms of the tariff?
Your Honor, I don't think that the Court of Appeals has addressed that exactly on point. I do know that the Court of Appeals, and I think the site of the case is the GMW case, which is cited in our briefs, did observe the rule, the principle, that the first, the terms and conditions of the tariff are binding, but second of all, that the rights and obligations of the parties cannot be enlarged beyond the tariff.
Counselor, aren't the you know, the cases on file rates started out with, are you charging the same amount? Are you charging what was filed? And then the cases developed to say, well, you know, services for which you pay a rate are kind of the other side of that coin. So you're going to change the services you give to one person as opposed to someone else, you violated the file rate. But aren't those different services than what we're talking about here, which is really checking on whether there's stray voltage only after the customer requests a check?
No, Your Honor, I don't think that that's an accurate way to describe the service. The service being provided is electric distribution service to the property.
That's right.
And it's the tariff talks about it ought to be provided at a certain level when it comes to stray voltage.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a performance standard, I would suggest.
But you never have to check for it unless the customer requests a check.
That's right, Your Honor, we don't. And the reason for that and why that makes sense is because there is always going to be some level on every property of neutral to ground voltage. Imagining for a moment there are some 15,000 dairy farms in this state, some 2,000 of those in NSP's territory. It would be inconceivable that the utility would have some duty or obligation to run around every one of these 2,000 farms on a constant basis, monitoring what the stray voltage is. It's the wisdom of the Public Service Commission, based on the science and based on the input they had to their legislatively mandated administrative procedures, that there is no duty of the utility to respond unless and until a property owner calls to inquire.
And suppose the stray voltage was in excess of the tariff. What's your liability?
Your Honor, if the stray voltage is in excess of the tariff, and we either failed to take the mitigation measures required by the tariff, or there is some evidence that we are doing something else outside of those requirements, which was reckless or willful to cause that condition above that and not to mitigate it, then I think there would be liability. But
what, for the excess over the minimum? And liability for what, damage to the herd?
I don't know how it would parse out. I suppose it would be damages to some extent for what happens to the herd in the situation.
Is that in the tariff? Does the tariff rate say that?
The tariff rate doesn't say that. What the tariff says is that we have to make sure that upon inquiry by the property owner that we keep the steady state under normal condition voltage below a certain level. And that has been done here, and there's no controversy to that point in the record.
What's a normal condition? Is a normal condition when you're running all your milking machines, or is a normal condition just whatever happens to occur at 8 o'clock in the morning, or is a normal condition? What's a normal condition?
Your Honor, I'm not sure exactly how a normal condition is defined, but I know that the Public Service Commission orders in both 1989 and 1996, I believe to some extent, defined what that is. And it's Northern State's contention on affidavits in the summary judgment record that it came in and it did the testing consistent with those conditions.
You know, it strikes me that this is similar to an argument that's being debated nationally. And various entities want to the courts to say that if the entity has a product that has been is regulated and approved by the government, then there's no liability for that product. So if you passed Food and Drug and they allow you to sell the drug or sell the food, then the court should not accept expert witnesses or any other evidence that that product caused, is defective and caused injury. Because by the very terms that it has been approved by a regulatory agency, that should be enough. Is that really what your argument is here? It's approved by the tariff rate, therefore no liability.
Your Honor, I don't think we're arguing something that extreme. I think what we're arguing, we're not asking for this court to give us a free pass on all liability to its customers in stray voltage. What we're saying is that when NSP complies with the specific terms and conditions of its tariff on testing and mitigation, that once we've met that threshold, another customer can't get effectively lower rates by suing us for maintaining that condition and getting damages.
That would be like a carnival ride which is inspected by the city or state or whatever, and it says safe, and then, of course, somebody is injured on it, and the plaintiff wants to show it's not safe, and the carnival company says, hey, good housekeeping seal of approval by the state of Wisconsin. It's, can't show that.
Your Honor,
your argument?
No, Your Honor, it's okay. Not, because I think in that case, while the underwriter stamp of approval may be persuasive, it's not legally preclusive.
Okay, but you're saying the tariff rate is legally preclusive.
Yes, under the filed rate doctrine it is, okay. Under the facts of this case.
Counsel, you say when it complies with the specific terms of testing, what specific terms of testing are you referencing that there would then be no liability?
Your Honor, the testing, I believe, is covered in Section 8 of NSP's tariff, and that tariff incorporates requirements by, I believe by reference, of the Commission's orders in dockets 05EI-106 and dockets 05EI-116. And certainly those are the principles that NSP must use to test in order to accomplish its requirements under the
Justice
tariff.
Justice Crooks asked you earlier about the Hoffman case. And in paragraph 12 of the Hoffman case, it indicates, we note that, and this is a follow-up of the Chief's question, too, we note that it is a well-established rule that the enactment of safety statutes or legislation given a commission jurisdiction over a certain activity does not abolish common law negligence. And then it gives a number of cites. It seems to me you're arguing to the contrary here, that in this case it does abolish the cause of action for common law negligence in this case.
Your Honor, I think that's correct. And while those case sites may be apropos for the proposition that regulatory guidelines or minimum safety standards don't overcome common law claims, I think the filed rate doctrine is very clear. And I don't think we can parse it out of the filed rate doctrine and still have a filed rate doctrine. And the rule under the filed rate doctrine is that once you comply with the terms and conditions of your tariff, once you provide service to your customers the way that the PSC has approved you will provide it at the rates that they've approved, you don't get to do something else.
Whose rule?
Excuse me?
Whose rule? You said the rule governs. Whose rule? The PSC?
Under the rules set forth in the tariff.
So the PSC rule governs.
Yes, Your Honor.
I still don't understand how you get around with Hoffman, which in essence in paragraph 12 says rules don't trump the common law.
Well, the principle at work here, Your Honor, is the one that we're trying to avoid, is judicial rate making that undermines a comprehensive regulatory scheme. That is a rule articulated under the filed tariff doctrine. And put into the context of this case and in Wisconsin, what we are in danger of having happening is having dozens of miniature PSCs in the context of every jury trial effectively setting different standards and rates and terms and conditions for how NSP is to provide its service.
I'm not sure I understand how that you're having different standards with respect to rates when what's at issue are issues of liability.
Your Honor, in terms of the rate, for example, if NSP can demonstrate in one case before a jury that it is provided stray voltage in accordance with its tariff at less than the 0.5 volt level of concern, and yet it is required to pay substantial damages for injury to cows, in effect what's happened there is the person winning those damages has obtained a service from NSP just as NSP has to provide to all of its other customers, but at a much lower rate. And that's where AT&T comes in and tells us that discrimination in charges, which I'll acknowledge were the first cases under the filed rate doctrine, can come in the form of a lower price for an equivalent service or in the form of an enhanced service for an equivalent price. If a plaintiff is allowed to get damages for stray voltage levels that come below the level of concern in the tariff, that's exactly what's going to be happening.
Counsel, so if I get your point here, you're saying we don't get to a factual question as to discovery, as to when the Schmidts knew or should have known that NSP's electricity was injuring their cows, because in 92, 93, 98, and 2000, you went out and, according to procedure, tested, and other than that test in 93 that was a simulated hypothetical situation, all the tests came back okay, and so that is a shield to liability. True?
True. And, you know, that leads me then to the statute of limitations question. Of course, if this court determines that the filed tariff doctrine precludes the Schmidts' claims, then there's no reason to visit the statute of limitations question. But NSP submits that in this case and under the summary judgment record, NSP was entitled to summary judgment on the question of whether the Schmidts' claims were barred under the statute of limitations.
Counsel, I want to make sure I understand your argument with respect to the rates. Maybe I'm missing something. And we talked a lot about medical malpractice type cases and analogies to that. So let's take a doctor that charges $10,000 for a surgical procedure. During the surgical procedure, commits malpractice. And I then sue the doctor for the malpractice action. Is it your argument that as a result of my, and I'm successful in the suit and I obtain damages, is it your argument that by obtaining damages that has reduced the rate that the doctor charged me for the surgery in the first place?
Your Honor, I wouldn't say that in the context, in the hypothetical you just mentioned, but I would say that in the context of a filed tariff, because rates are provided to all customers, or services are provided to all customers at a predetermined rate and at a predetermined level of service. And if a level of service is expected greater than that provided, whether or not there are damages associated with it, then one customer is getting a better deal than other customers. And NSP is in a unique industry where it has to provide service to all comers, and the law of the land is that they have to do that under terms and conditions that are included in a tariff. They can't change those unless those are approved by the Public Service Commission.
So the Public Service Commission essentially gets to trump Hoffman, which said you could recover damages for less than a 0.5 voltage level, correct?
I think that once the procedures are incorporated into a tariff, I think that is a different legal analysis than Hoffman.
Okay, but that, I understand it's a different legal analysis. I certainly agree with you, but question is, the Public Service Commission then trumps our statement in Hoffman, which said you could get damages for less than 0.5 voltage levels.
I think, put that succinctly, yes. I think once the Public Service Commission orders a utility to put those terms and conditions in its tariff, mm-hmm. then that is a different ballgame.
Okay, and so the only way around this for the farmer is that the farmer's got to have an expert that shows
A, the level is higher than 0.5, and the jury then has to decide whether the PSC negligently, not the PSC, the utility negligently performed their tests or not.
Your Honor, no, I think what has to happen is that an expert would have to opine that NSP didn't follow the testing conventions it was supposed to, and that if it had, the results would have been different and that NSP would have had to mitigate those.
Well, if they're not standing there looking over their shoulder, that seems a pretty heavy burden to try to have them say they didn't follow the procedures they were supposed to. I mean,
give me a group of facts under which that would become an issue of fact for a jury.
With the testing, Your Honor?
Yeah, right.
I think that if NSP went out, I think certainly any plaintiff could have some of their own person there or could observe, as I think they did in this case, and could observe what NSP was doing. I think also NSP might be required, if there were enough evidence put in the summary judgment record to create a genuine issue, would be required to demonstrate that they followed those procedures. So I think there could be a set of facts based on, I mean, there are all kinds of stray voltage experts who have a lot of continuing work in this state, who are very familiar with what the utilities do and who could make a case, if the facts were there, that the utility didn't comply with the requirements of its tariff.
If we would hold in your favor, would we have to withdraw, overturn, whatever language you want to use, the following sentence from Hoffman? Nowhere in the language of Chapter 196 of the Wisconsin statutes is common law negligence with respect to stray voltage changed or altered.
I think you would, Your Honor, because
you disagree with that, because you're saying the tariff is under 196.
Yes, because the tariff is under 196.
And therefore, that the tariff does change. Maybe not all of 196 changes, but the tariff does. That's your position.
Yes, Your Honor.
As I understand it. Let me just ask you one other thing. I can't remember this from Hoffman well enough. What's traditional stray voltage and non-traditional stray voltage? That seemed to be matter in Hoffman.
Your Honor, I think that is another distinction in Hoffman. I think Hoffman was about what's called non-traditional stray voltage, which doesn't have to do with the steady state in normal conditions. Here in this case, the allegations, as I understand them, are traditional stray voltage.
We okay, whatever those mean. Thank you. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal, counsel. Okay?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Ms. Attorney Neeson, representing the Schmitz. You have 20 minutes. It might help if you would tell us what issues you're going to deal with and what issues your co-counsel will deal with. So the court will direct its questions appropriately, but I can't guarantee that will happen.
May it please the court and counsel, I will be addressing the statute of limitations issues, and my co-counsel, Charlie Bird, will be discussing the filed rate, filed tariff issues. My issues include, when did Mr. Schmidt discover stray voltage on his farm, the continuum of negligence, the estoppel issue, and the continuing nuisance doctrine.
What was the last one? I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you.
Continuing nuisance doctrine.
Okay.
First and foremost, I do want to present an exhibit to the court. I'd ask that for permission that be distributed. It's a portion of Record 58, select pages from 58.
Has opposing counsel seen that?
Yes.
Do you have any objection?
No.
All right. You know, all of this is part of the record, but you're putting it in a different form, if I understand your comment.
Right. I'm just selecting portions of that record.
Okay. Thank you.
First, I need to clarify some misrepresentations made by NSP, which are so fundamental to this case that I'd be remiss in not asserting them at this point. They assert at no time did NSP ever measure stray voltage at cow contact points above the level of concern unless the farm was in a hypothetical situation. But taking a look at the testing results back in 1993, we can see from the first two tests, a test which was conducted on July 1st and a subsequent test which was conducted on July 22nd, that those two were done under hypothetical situations. The comment section at the bottom of those pages indicate that it was only after bonding the barn neutral to the stanchions was a test conducted. Now we look at the September 15th test. There's no similar comment. It's our position that this September 15th, 1993 test was done under normal farm conditions. And this test, the September 15th test, does show cow contact voltage in excess of the level of concern. Normal conditions, above the level of concern. Now we have to turn to what did Mr. Schmidt know? What did the Schmidts know? Well, Mr. Schmidt in his deposition said, we simulated a plastic water line by hooking all of the stalls together and bonding them to the neutral. That's the only way the power company could ever come up with a reading. That's in his deposition. He knew of the hypothetical tests, and he knew that was the only way that they could come up with a reading. He did not know about this critical September 1993 test. So there's a question of fact. Did NSP actually comply with their tariff? Did NSP actually disclose this information to Mr. Schmidt? And did that failure to disclose go to when during this spectrum, between 1993 and 2001, when did he discover that he had a stray voltage problem? We have a number of questions of fact. Because the Schmidts had no evidence of an underlying fundamental design flaw in NSP's distribution system until 2001, we have a question of fact in that regard. The Schmidts were aware in 1993 that they had some concrete discrete problems, such as a down neutral line and an inadequate transformer. That was told to them by their electrician hired to do rewiring on the farm. They had that information. But NSP maintains, even to this day, that there was no stray voltage on the farm. They completely ignore that September 1993 test. And even Mr. Schnack, their NSP's own electrical expert, indicates in his affidavit, I've reviewed all the tests, there was never any stray voltage on the farm. Incorrect. There's also a question of fact whether or not NSP did disclose this crucial test to the Schmidts. And all of those taken together show that summary judgment was inappropriate in this case.
So you would have a jury instruction on the basis of at least the facts as you know them at the moment, if we went to a jury trial?
Right, if we had been to a jury trial.
Not a question of law here.
It's not a question of law, it's a question of fact. Clearly a question of fact. Let me turn to the continuing nuisance.
Help me.
Sure.
On your chart, let's take the September 15th, 93. Where precisely is the evidence that there's something in excess of the level of concern?
There's a bolded section in the middle of the page where it says, are off-farm sources causing more than 1 milliamp in the cow contact area? Now, that is the level of concern as established by the PSCW.
And they
mark yes.
And why is circled? Is that your point?
Right. They indicate yes. And that means off-farm, NSP's distribution system is causing that excess or that voltage in excess of the level of concern. If you look at the two tests that predate that, the July 1st and the July 22nd, on both of those tests, they mark no. So the farmer can reasonably deduce from that information that it's his farm, that his farm is causing the problems. It's not NSP's distribution system. But it's only when we get to that September test when it attributes the voltage, excess voltage, to the off-farm sources that a farmer could deduce that it's no longer his farm, no longer.
Does it tell him that it's Northern State?
It does not state in here that it's Northern State, but it does say that it's an off-farm source. And a reasonable conclusion could then be the distribution system.
What is that 5.513 in the next line? Calculated secondary volt drop. Is that something I should pay attention to?
Well, there's a voltage drop that occurs between the primary and the secondary line. The secondary neutral line is bonded to the primary line. And so when you change from that primary to the secondary, there is a drop. But nonetheless, you're still in excess of the level of concern.
Counsel, when do you claim that your clients discovered that there was a problem and it was attributable to NSP?
In 2001, they had received a report from Schmidt Electric, no relation to our clients, but they received a report indicating that the cause of the problems on the farm were attributable to the distribution system. Schmidt Electric also identified the grounding system as being inadequate. He also indicated that was a problem with maintenance. But all of that is included in the Schmidt Electric report in the record.
And then you commenced a suit in November of 2001?
Immediately thereafter, same year.
This September 15th was never provided to the plaintiffs?
Correct. The NSP is indicating that it was provided. However, what the proof that we have at this point, the evidence that we have, is that NSP required all of their requests for data to be in writing. Therefore, the Schmidts, Carlene, wrote a letter in August 1993 to NSP requesting the July tests and also requesting any future tests. NSP has admitted that they have documentation of who receives what data, but they've provided no proof that our clients have received that September 1993 result. And if you look at the deposition testimony of Mr. Schmidt, he says the only way that they could ever get readings above the level of concern was to hook the farm up in this hypothetical situation. And we submit that as the September test was done under normal farm conditions, he wasn't aware of that test. I'd like to turn briefly to the continuing nuisance doctrine. Statute of limitations cannot expire on a continuing nuisance claim. The 2001 report by Schmidt Electric evidences that stray voltage was on the farm in 2001, and thus damages should not be barred. To uphold the trial court in this matter would give NSP a license to continue harming, to continue victimizing the farmer, and it essentially grants them a prescriptive easement over the land. It would be impossible to hold the utilities accountable. As such, the Schmidts should be entitled to seek damages for the duration of their injuries, the duration of the nuisance, and to obtain injunctive relief from NSP. A doctrine was also suggested in Colpine, Continuum of Negligent Acts. While the facts pertaining to the Schmidt case are slightly different than those in Colpine, the Court of Appeals decision in Schmidt does not deviate. In Colpine, the Continuum of Separate Negligent Acts was recognized, but the court refused to apply the doctrine because only one negligent act was alleged, and that was negligent use of the distribution system. In this case, we've alleged various acts of negligence, including the ongoing failure to warn, the ongoing use of improper equipment, ongoing negligence, and failure in distributing electricity, and failure to adequately inspect. Those are all supported by the Schmidt Electric report. Therefore, in the Schmidt case, under the Continuum of Negligent Acts, the claim should not be barred. And finally, I do want to address the estoppel issue. NSP failed to provide this very critical test to the Schmitz. They failed to inform the test that there, or the Schmitz, that there was a test that showed voltage in excess of the level of concern and that it was attributable to something off-farm. They failed to provide the Schmitz with that critical, critical information. They should be stopped from asserting the statute of limitation defense because of that inequitable conduct. And, in fact, the most telling of all of this is that they maintain to this day that there was never any stray voltage above the level of concern on that farm, and that's not true. They're misleading the court, and that test should be recognized. And I think, in all fairness, the estoppel should be applied, and they should be prevented from raising that statute of limitations defense. And as the filed tariff doctrine was discussed at quite large length, I'd like to defer to Charlie Bird with the court's permission so that he can discuss the filed tariff doctrine.
Are there any further questions of Ms. Neeson regarding the statute of limitations issue? All right. Thank you, counsel. Attorney Bird.
May it please the court and counsel. I'm going to speak regarding two issues here today. First, I want to discuss the filed rate doctrine, the notion that that doctrine can impliedly limit liability arising out of tariffs that are not correlated with prices for electricity. Secondly, I want to address briefly the claim that NSP has limited its liability for stray voltage by virtue of this continuity of service provision in its tariff. There is a case that I did not cite in my brief that I want to cite for you, and I was remiss in not doing it, and that is the Zumberge, Zumberge, versus Northern States Power, 481 Northwest 2nd, 103, a Minnesota Court of Appeals case on the precise issue that they raise in their brief as to whether or not use of service in that continuity of service provision applies. And the court held in that case that it did not, and I can you can see that. And if I get a chance, I'll get back to it later because I know you're interested in this other issue. The stray voltage tariff that's in the record here does not give NSP the right to put stray voltage through the Schmitz farm. If you want to turn to the appendix in this case, 132, and look at Section 8.0, Rules and Regulations, what it says in 8.0A is that under normal operating conditions, whatever those may be, neutral to earth current may exist on the grounded and grounding conductors or other parts of the system. 8.0B is the first time where we discuss stray voltage. And stray voltage is described as a 60 hertz steady state AC RMS that can be measured across a 500 ohm shunt resistor. 8.0A, which is what they're relying on for this so-called authority to dump stray voltage onto the farm, does not give them authority to dump stray voltage at cow contact points. It literally does not do that. So one of their fundamental premises of their argument is simply lacking. Now, the stray voltage tariff in the record has nothing to do with the price of electricity. It is instead related to stray voltage. The stray voltage tariff relates to the narrow issue of who pays for isolation of the primary neutral from the secondary neutral system so as to attempt to shield the customer from the unwanted effects of stray voltage. The stray voltage tariff, if you'll read it through, it's at 132 here, does not seek, the Public Service Commission did not approve, and there is no authority for the Public Service Commission to approve, that they had any jurisdiction to approve, any limitation on liability for damages arising out of the unpaid for and unwanted use of the customer's property as part of the return circuit for NSP's phase current to other customers. And Wisconsin Statute 196-857 does not give the Public Service Commission authority to award damages or to limit liability for a utility for stray voltage. As long ago as Kemp versus Webco in 1969 and confirmed by this court in Hoffman, this court adopted the rule that nothing in Chapter 196 limited common law rights for negligence or nuisance. The claim is made of discrimination, that there's somehow discrimination here arising out of this grant of authority in the tariff. But that's undone because the stray voltage given any customer is not uniform. It's not metered in any way. It's not paid for by the customer, and nobody wants it. NSP, therefore, fundamentally lacks foundation for the assertion that customers are being treated the same as it relates to stray voltage. And if you go to the AT&T case sets forth a correct rule, which is that service is related to price. But here we have an unwanted service. This is not a service. It's a detriment to the farm. And the measure for discriminatory treatment in all of the filed rate cases is grounded in the price. And whether it's the price for a telephone call or an AT&T switchless services, it's relating to the price that they've set forth for the services. Now, NSP seeks to distinguish the holding of this court in Hoffman, claiming that Hoffman did not address the filed rate doctrine. While that is literally true, that ignores the fact that Hoffman did address something even more fundamental, and that's the power given to the PSC to limit liability for common law damages. Case law universally applied, and we've set that out. There's a really good Texas case, I think, that canvasses this whole subject, is that authority given to utilities to limit common law liability for cases such as this is narrowly construed. And there's four general criteria that are applied. First, in order for the PSC to authorize a tariff that limits liability, permission must be granted to the PSC in the enabling legislation, Chapter 196. The claim of limited liability has to be expressly claimed by the utility. For example, there is an express claim of limitation of liability in the continuity of service provision, but there's not in this stray voltage tariff. The claim of limitation of liability has to be narrowly drawn so as to avoid public policy considerations. And NSP's stray voltage tariff meets none of those requirements.
Mr. Byrd, wasn't there an attempt with the Wisconsin legislature to insert some language that would grant immunity to power companies?
Yes.
What happened with that?
Well, that's mentioned. It's described in the Hoffman decision, and it was that legislation was withdrawn, and I think it was one of the reasons why this court decided in Hoffman, you know, you don't have the authority. I mean, if you want to get it, you got to go to the legislature to get it. You don't get it by what they're asserting, implication, where it's not expressly claimed and they don't have the authority to grant it. So I want to just move briefly to the continuity of service provision. First of all, that provision we don't think is part of the record, and we cite the Discount Fabric House case at page 39 of our brief. But I want to also address the merits of the continuity of service provision. We have two courts in Minnesota that have addressed that particular provision, not identical language, but strikingly similar. and also one in Texas, which is the Southwest Power versus Grant case that's cited in both briefs. And both, all three of these courts have rejected the claim that somehow this is a broad limitation on liability, but instead of narrowly construed it to refer to simply power outages, continuity of service meaning the power is interrupted. And the Zumbergi case that I cited earlier specifically addressed this precise argument and held that that provision, narrowly construed, related only to power outages, and the Schmidts are not claiming damages from a power outage. And the court held that NSP's broad interpretation of the use of service language violate public policy and did not, and the damages did not arise, literally arise out of use of service, the customer's use of service. In fact, Mr. Ryberg here earlier today indicated there was no use of service issue. If you'll sort of surprise me that he said that, but in a stray voltage context, there's no issue with respect to use of service. But instead, the court held that it arose out of defects in the distribution system. And in a colorful analogy, the Minnesota Court of Appeals noted that NSP conceded in that case that stray voltage was a controllable phenomenon and would not countenance limitations on stray voltage damages because, what they said, a tiger in a cage is different than a tiger loose on the street. And the continuity of service provision in NSP's Wisconsin tariff should have similar treatment by this court. I have nothing further to say, unless you have some questions.
Counselor, do you agree with the position of opposing counsel that if this matter went to trial, the only way that you could show that Northern States Power did not properly conduct the test set out in the tariff as if there was someone standing at their shoulder and observing what their procedures were?
No. No, first of all, I disagree with the whole notion.
I understand that.
Yeah. I'm not sure I'm totally understanding the question, but if the problem is, and I think Chief Justice Abramson hit it on the head, which is, you know, we're going to test once in a while. And there's no doubt that current wildly fluctuates on the farm throughout a day, all day. And it's particularly bad, for example, at milking time because all the farmers are turning on their milkers. You've got single-phase service here. You literally do not have a three-phase grounded Y at the Schmidt farm. You've got a single-phase tap, which, you know, if we ever get to a jury, we're going to be able to establish that when you have three-phase current and 120 degrees per phase that's completely balanced, you're not going to have stray voltage. So the notion that somehow we're always going to have current going into the ground is not true on a properly balanced system. It's when you bring out these single-phase taps that, you create this problem because the phases then get out of balance. And then the whole rest of it is these issues associated with ongoing maintenance, which, so at any given time in the day, and Mr. Schmidt noted that in his record, he had a very limited time to test, and if he'd had a lot longer time, the Court of Appeals noted this, undoubtedly would have been much greater spikes in the current. So I don't know if that answers your question.
Yeah, no, it does. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Minden, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Address the last page of this exhibit?
Your Honor, yes, I would like to address that. I think what's happening here is that plaintiffs at this late stage, after the summary judgment record was created, are trying to now create genuine issues of fact. What we have in the summary judgment record is an affidavit from Kevin Schnack in which Mr. Schnack says, and this wasn't controverted on the summary judgment record, that every one of these tests were taken under hypothetical scenarios, that it concedes that in those hypothetical scenarios, not normal operating conditions, readings of over 0.5 volt were observed, and that there was action taken, the installation of what's called an equipotential plane in late 1993 to make sure that these hypothetical conditions, if ever made real by actions of the farmer, wouldn't result in stray voltage over 0.5 volts. So that was installed. The affidavit also says, and I don't believe it's controverted, that cow contact measurements taken after making those changes never exceeded the level of concern when NSP took those tests. So what we have here is an effort to create a fact where none was created on the summary judgment record. And that...
Well, would you acknowledge or would you concede that if this had been introduced at the summary judgment hearing or supplied to the court, that the September 1993 document would create a genuine issue of material fact?
Your Honor, no, because they've, contrary to what I think they were trying to suggest here, this document was in the plaintiff's hands well before the summary judgment proceeding. Moreover, the tests that were conducted on the Schmidt farm in 1993, at which more than 0.5 volts were observed in the hypothetical grounding conditions, were both observed by the Schmidts. The Schmidts knew it. They admitted in their depositions that they knew it on the record, and I'd refer the court to our reply brief for those transcript sites. But they knew that those measurements above 0.5 volts were taken. And this was all part of the flurry of activity in 1993.
It's being suggested by your opposing counsel that this document that I'm referring to, the September 1993 analysis report, is not taken under a hypothetical situation, and that it is attributing a concentration or a level above the level of concern, and that it states it is from an off-farm source.
Your Honor, the sole basis for that contention is the absence of comments at the bottom of that third page.
At well, not the sole, with regard to hypothetical, maybe, yes.
With regard to the hypothetical.
Together, are off-farm sources causing more than 1 MA in the CC area? The answer is yes. So with regard to those others, it appears as though this documents that. Maybe I'm wrong, though.
Right. But what the trial court had before it on summary judgment, and which remains uncontroverted, is the testimony of Mr. Schnack, in which he talks about receiving all of these above 0.5 volt readings, what NSP did in compliance with its tariff to mitigate those, arguably even went further than it needed to, and that any measurements taken after that in 1993, all the way until 2001 when they sued, were below the level of concern. We are not looking, I think that what's happened here is we have a straw man. We're not looking for immunity, complete immunity. What we are looking for is that the court give effect to the level of concern in the tariff beyond which we are supposed to act and below which we are not required to act. That does not mean that if the court gives effect to that tariff, that NSP is not going to have any liability, nor does it mean that the plaintiffs wouldn't be able to sue in the appropriate case or take any number of actions at the Public Service Commission, either to change the tariff or to take a look at NSP's distribution system or other things to make sure that they're not subject to continuing problems. I would assert that the tiger is in the cage, and it's in the cage by virtue of the decades of study that the Public Service Commission has done and the determination by the Public Service Commission that below a certain level there isn't a danger to property and that the utility need not act. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Hamiden. Thank you, Mr. Berg, and thank you, Ms. Nielsen, for your arguments today, which overlap somewhat but in a very different fact situation with the arguments that we heard in our first case. That concludes our argument in 2005 AP 1677, Schmidt versus Northern States Power Company. The court is in recess until 1:30 when we will hear our third case today. We are in recess.